Monster Professor.
Welcome to The Monster Professor, a show in which we discuss and explore monsters and literature, myth, film, games, folklore, culture, and beyond. I'm your host, Josh Woods, author, editor, professor, and monster expert. And a few housekeeping notes before we get going on our monster focus for today. One, you might have noticed some episodes are coming out infrequently, though still coming out, but infrequently. And if that makes you mad and turns you into a certain kind of monster, I have a solution. How about if you haven't already subscribed to the show on whichever platform you listen to it on, YouTube or Apple Music or Apple Podcasts, I should say, Spotify or Stitcher or Google Play or you name it, so you can get notified when episodes come out so you don't have to watch for my schedule. It'll just let you know when a new episode is out. We got a bunch of cool ones lined up this year, but I'm not sure it's going to be like an every week or every other week kind of thing. In fact, I know it's not going to anymore. I mention all this right away because I'm going to forget, because I keep forgetting to plug my own show when I have, like recently, I've had some awesome guests on and I plug their stuff and I can never remember to say, hey, like and subscribe. It really helps me out. Because I do this for free, I do it for fun, I do it for the love of monsters and for people who love monsters as well. So any little bit of support or like or subscribe really helps me out. I appreciate it. And I keep forgetting to plug my own books as well, and I very nearly forgot. I started to move on in the episode and then cut and came back. By the way, if you're new to this show, another way you can check out other projects I'm getting into is checking out my books. I've got a book of short stories, O Monstrous World, put out by Press 53, available to buy or order wherever books are sold. Check out Press 53's website, by the way, if you're into awesome literary fiction. O Monstrous World is literary / horror fiction, if I had to nail it down to a couple genres. And I've got a book, The Black Palace. That's a novel, and that's available on Amazon.com. Check those out. Okay, that's enough self-promotion. So how about today, let's get into monstrous plagues. And let's just jump right in, forget my little music thing I normally do right here. Let's just get right into it, because life might very well be short. At this point, I'm recording early March 2020, and although I'm pretty clueless about what's going on in the modern news world, if it didn't happen before 1600, I don't really know much about it. Maybe that's not a big surprise, given my obsession with monsters. There were more of them back then than there are now, I guess is why. But anyway, it finally came to even my attention that there's a plague going on around the world, like the real world right now. COVID-19, I think it is, or people are calling it the coronavirus. And I must be honest, I really don't know much about it other than people are taking it very seriously. And somebody recently asked me whether I'm prepared for it. And that's a tough one, because my ignorance of things going on in the world would lead one to believe, including myself, that I'm not very prepared for these kinds of things. However, when we get down to the details, you're talking to a guy who actually has a fully stocked vampire slaying kit just in case vampires start being real. And so I might very well be as prepared for a plague as anybody possibly could be. I won't go into any details, but holy water is ready, even if that is required. With all that said, I figured, well, we haven't really done a monstrous plagues episode yet, so let's run through some. But I noticed there's already an excellent article that kind of does this, that tracks plagues in literature. It's by, I don't know who this writer is, although I'll have to start checking into his stuff more often because I like this article. It's by a guy named Adam Roberts. It was published in The Guardian, and it's called Fever Dreams, and it's about It's his response to this notion that's been popping around in the past few weeks that the virus going on right now was predicted by author Dean Koontz. Dean Koontz is an awesome writer, by the way. Some of his short stories actually got me writing short stories way back in the day out of his collection of short stories, Strange Highways, which are much better than I think they get praised for, or they don't get praised enough, perhaps is how I should say it. Anyway, he wrote a novel years back, The Eyes of Darkness, in which he postulated this future fictional virus, Wuhan 400, a virus that came out of the Wuhan province in China. And it sounds like that's where this current one came out. I don't think the similarities continue past that point. Adam Roberts goes into a whole lot of other plagues, starting with the works of Homer up to a lot of pop culture ones now. So rather than cover those that he covered, I would cover some that maybe he didn't. And big surprise, the ones he didn't are the ones that are a little bit more interesting to me. He didn't even cover the plagues of Egypt. And those are some of the coolest plagues. I guess only one of them is very virus-like, the boils attack, well, and the livestock plagues. But frogs and a rain of hail and fiery hail and darkness and rivers to blood and these kinds of things don't typically produce the same symptoms that viruses do. There's some crossover there, I think. But some of the coolest plagues to me, if I were going to just launch them out right now and then get into them as much as my time allows here, Edgar Allan Poe's Mask of the Red Death. There's just no getting around that one. And I think that how he handles the plague in that story, the Red Death, says a lot about the kind of thing I think you might end up seeing if this plague continues to get serious or gets more and more serious, or you might have already seen it. The Color Out of Space with Lovecraft, by Lovecraft. Then you got the zombie viruses, of course, and in literature and film and TV, and a John Carpenter virus or his version of one. Let's see if we can get to all of those. Let's first start, though, with a historical plague. It has to be one of the cool, if plagues can be cool. I guess I should take this a little bit more seriously, since I might very well be dead by this plague by the time you're listening to this thing. But with that said, if I am allowed to say plagues can be cool, the coolest plague in history that I know of is that dance plague. Now, there were a whole bunch of different dance plagues, believe it or not, throughout history, but the famous one is the dance plague of 1518, and that was it. It was 1518, isn't it? I better double check my sources. Sometimes I say the wrong things with such confidence so often. It is 1518. Okay. I say wrong things with such confidence so often that it's worth checking all the things I say, even if you're me. All right. So 1518 in Strasbourg, which is at this time in the Holy Roman Empire, it's right. We would say now it's right on the, in France, right on the border between France and Germany. At this time, the Holy Roman Empire, which Barzun or Bloom said the Holy Roman Empire, which was neither holy nor Roman nor an empire, but they had a plague breakout in which a lady started dancing. Now, I think it might have started on the feast of Saint Vitus or Vitus. I don't know how you pronounce his name precisely. And if you dance in front of like a symbol or an image of St. Vitus on his feast day, then you have better luck for the year. And so I think the story goes she started dancing in front of that. Regardless, they say her name is Frau Trofea, and I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong too. But there you go. Let's just call it Frau Trofea. She started dancing. And she just wouldn't stop. And then more people joined her, and more people joined her, and more people joined her week after week. Within several weeks, over 400 people were dancing, but they just wouldn't stop. Now, I think surely they got food and water into them while they were dancing, but it was like catching on like a contagion. And the authorities and the medical professionals at the time, you know, the 1500s versions of these things, they prescribed continuing to dance. Like if what your body's forcing you to do is dance against your will until you're exhausted, just dance yourself to exhaustion. That's at a time when the world of medicine was still playing with this idea of inflammatory cures, as in rather than trying to reduce symptoms, just go ahead and increase them as fast as possible so they'll burn themselves out, and then they'll be over and done with, and you can heal up, like getting into a hot bath to fight a hot fever or something rather than a cold. Well, that didn't necessarily work in this case, and people started dropping dead at the height of it. They say, sources say anyway, that 15 people were dying a day, and more people were just coming and dancing until they're dead, and they just couldn't stop. And music was being played by order of the physicians who wanted to keep it going to help them out, but that didn't work at all. It eventually dwindled down after, God, I don't know. I don't know how many ended up dying. I'm sure in the hundreds, but it's probably hard to tell. Anyway, all sorts of explanations go on. Some say, well, most of the victims were female, so it was some sort of strange repression of the era finally lifted, or others at the time were suspecting some type of hysteria. I don't know about that. Others were suspecting some type of, nowadays they'll retrospect, some types of LSD drugs or some LSD-like compound that ended up in the water supply. Some have thought strange, like brain-affecting bacteria. Truth is, we just don't know, but it happened more than just that time. But it was a real thing, whether it was some type of psychological delusion or whether some force was forcing them to dance against their will. That's beyond our knowledge. I guess we'll never know unless it starts up again. I don't know. I'm reminded of a famous YouTube video of a concert in which some very drugged up guy just starts dancing in a silly manner on the side of a hill at some open air concert, and somebody else joins them to mock him, but others join that guy, and then others and others join. And within the end of the song, hundreds, if not thousands, of people are dancing crazily along with this guy. I don't know. What if wilder possibilities were in your brain and you're in that crowd? Would you end up being this part of this dance plague in which you danced yourself to death? I don't know. Maybe. I mean, the idea is fascinating to me. Okay. How about let's jump over to Mask of the Red Death. Briefly enough to say, like, why I think that matters. You've got Prince Prospero, who has all the worldly power and money and riches and friends anyone could ever imagine. So much so that the whole story is kind of painted abstractly in broad colors, and each room and hall has a color and really heavy symbols like the clock and very symbolic like names like Prospero. And The basic setup is that the Red Death is sweeping the land, and Prospero says, you know what, I'm gonna lock down and hole up and wait this whole thing out, and it won't get me in here. And so he's got a fortress castle, and he fortifies it, but he makes sure to supply himself with all the food and liquor and musicians you could possibly ask for, all the costumes and clothes and entertainment. He also has all of his friends come in, none of whom are infected, in theory, and they all just party day and night, completely locking out the outside world. And then, wouldn't you know, at one point, the Red Death himself walks into the masquerade and then unmasks, and then therein lies everyone's ultimate demise. You can't lock out the thing that can't be locked out, no matter how much money and power you have. And so, is that the kind of thing that you end up seeing? You see the cracks in the psyche and the perceived safety among the rich and the powerful right now with the coronavirus? I honestly don't keep up with the news enough to know, but if you haven't yet, Edgar Allan Poe predicts that you will, and so the Monster Professor might have to agree with Edgar Allan Poe on this one. But I think kind of what's going on there as well. Well, he's named Prince Prospero, and who's the other famous Prospero in literature? Prospero from The Tempest, right? The wizard, the extremely powerful, if not all-powerful, wizard who lives on an island with his daughter and his servants, and his magical servants, Caliban, which I want to talk about in a future episode, by the way, and Ariel. And he's got power, he's got the a mini Earth all to himself, and so he's got everything kind of under control and locked down the way he would want it. But wouldn't you know, a shipwreck ends up throwing some people on the island. Now, did he have something to do with that? Well, yeah, I guess so. But still, no matter how cut off you are, no matter how much you're in an island, as in Prospero, or you make a fortress, an island-like fortress, like the Edgar Allan Poe's Prospero, that contamination will always cross borders. And I think a fear of contamination and the response being shut down borders or build borders, some have even posited that that's one of the very few fundamental differences between political wings, that the right wing fears contamination and wants clear-cut borders and clear-cut categories, even for ideas, and a left wing does not fear it and wants open borders and cross-category or no categories at all, although that might be falling apart the more examples that pop up into my mind. But there, regardless, maybe it's not a political issue at all. There's something in the human mind that very much wants borders and fears contamination. And at least Edgar Allan Poe tries to show in one aspect with Mask of the Red Death, there's no keeping that out. Like Monster Professor Josh Woods, no matter how much you don't want to be aware of the news, it will find its way to you. And so maybe that's more of a lesson for me than anyone else. All right, other things I want to get to. Oh, Color Out of Space by H.P. Lovecraft. Recently reread it for this podcast just a few days ago. Such a cool story. Although I've also found out through more than one experiment that you cannot convince other people to like Lovecraft. He's one of those writers you can't convert others to appreciate or like. You either are just a Lovecraft person or you're not, and I'm finally coming to terms with that. Even other writers that I absolutely love that sometimes are hated or belittled, J.R.R. Tolkien, for instance, you can make a case, you can argue in such a way that careful readers and smart people can be convinced to at least appreciate him. I don't think you can do that with Lovecraft. I really think it's, I can set up an argument and try to get you to like Lovecraft, and it might hold up on its own terms, but it'll never work. So it's So if you're not into Lovecraft, I really can't, I will shall no longer argue with anybody who feels that way. But I love them. And The Color Out of Space is this really, and by the way, they just made a recent Nicolas Cage movie, The Color Out of Space. The same people who made Mandy, which was a fantastic and horrifying film, they made The Color Out of Space. I prefer Mandy, but Lovecraft is hard to film, man. It really is, and I can't point to successes. But The Color Out of Space is essentially meteorite hits this remote New England farm, and then weird stuff starts happening, and it has something to do with this. The color of this thing that spreads like a plague, but it's not really a color so much as Lovecraft says. It can only be called color as an analogy. The strangeness is not color exactly, but that's the closest thing we have words for. It seems somewhat radioactive, or at least a pop culture version of radioactive, but it starts mutating things. And I think that might be kind of a segue to the other plagues and what might be at the heart of monstrous plagues and stories and literature is this transformation or mutation. But one of the things that starts spreading into the landscape, into the trees, into the people, into the earth itself, into the water, into the animals is this gray, brittle death in which you're slowly like cracking apart, almost like glass. At least that's how I'm envisioning it, and this whole land becomes blighted with this strange, horrible, ancient color radioactive plague thing. The absolute coolest version I've ever seen of somebody rendering this story out more visually, believe it or not, is a video game. It's called The Darkest Dungeon. I'm sure I've mentioned it on this show before. It's a fantastic video game available on Steam. Go check it out and support the indie group who made this thing. Beautiful artwork, very much inspired by Mike Mignola, the artist who created Hellboy. And they had an add-on to this game called The Color of Madness, in which a meteorite hits a farm and spreads this weird radioactive brittle death that is prismatic and colorful in some way. But the way they render it, as in it kind of turns everything ghostly and crystalline, and everything kind of breaks apart but gets super powered, and they go with this weird strange turquoise type of glowing color. But I think one of the coolest features, not only does everything kind of start growing and turning crystalline, but like the farm horses and the farm hands and the farmer himself, everything starts like breaking apart and fading away in a zero gravity kind of image, but they still hold together as if the arm was still there connected to the hand, right? So the hand will float along with shards of an arm, but it will be as if the arm's still there, even though it's not. And that it's really hard to create an uncanny effect like that visually when you can see it all clearly. It's easier, I think, or at least more accessible to do that through words than through visuals, because you have all the evidence right before your eyes when it's a visual, and yet they somehow do it. So absolute props to that artistic group who created Darkest Dungeon. Okay. All right, where am I now? Okay, I think I can get through all the ones I want to talk about within 40 minutes. I'm going to try. That's my goal. So how about let me jump back to that idea of this, the plague being this thing that transforms you. That's at the heart of the zombie stories. I know we've done a whole episode on the zombie before, but we'd never really focused on what in these stories turns everyone to zombies. And most of the time, in most stories, it's some type of spreading plague, whether that's a virus or a bacteria or some or one thing or another. Now, in a lot of these zombie stories, most famously, say in Romero's Night of the Living Dead, it remains ambiguous. You don't really know what causes it. Some suspicion that it's something from space. Some, well, who knows? All sorts of suspicions pop up in that movie. But all of them could kind of hinge on this idea of a plague or a disease. And in the first true... The most influential of the first zombie stories, Richard Matheson's I Am Legend. I mean, that's essentially where Romero got his inspiration for Night of the Living Dead. That's where I think all zombie stories came out of, even though the zombies were kind of technically vampires, but they were just all zombies. And so you have Zombie Apocalypse Story, the first one, I Am Legend. And that was a disease, vampirus, if I'm remembering correctly, that had all these symptoms that matched up with old legends of vampires, and like photosensitive, like reanimation of the dead and photosensitivity, as in they can't be out in sunlight and these kinds of things. In probably the most widely popular zombie story, The Walking Dead TV show based on The Walking Dead graphic novels, that one was a virus. TS-19, I think, was the name of the virus. One of the coolest was Max Brooks's novel, World War Z, which I think has nothing to do with the film. I read the book. I have not seen the film called World War Z, and I'm told don't bother. and I'm fine with not bothering. But I will absolutely recommend the book. Fantastic book. And that is a plague spread worldwide that came out of China, wouldn't you know? And I don't know if many people are talking about World War Z, but the Chinese government decided to flood out this ancient valley with these ancient secret temples. And what it did was release this long-kept plague or virus that may or may not have been contained by wise men of ages long since gone, and it spreads and people turn into zombies. I think one of the cool things that Walking Dead did was posit, at least the TV show, and I honestly know that better than the graphic novels, it posits that this virus or the zombie plague, that it's airborne and everyone has it. You only are really affected by it after you're deceased. Then, no matter how you were deceased, you rise back up. Now, I'm not sure that they were 100% consistent with that idea, which maybe is a clue that they didn't fully commit to it, but they at least played with that idea, and it seemed true, at least in some seasons. And I think that's fascinating that would really hit at the heart of their title, The Walking Dead, of the many ways they've kind of played with reinterpreting that title. One is that every character on the show is a zombie waiting to happen. It's just a matter of time. It's just a matter of when that's going to happen, because everybody is pre-zombie. I think other zombie stories have played with that idea as well. What's at the heart of that plague part of the fear? You don't need the virus, the bacteria, the plague to have zombie stories, right? But so many of them do that anyway. Well, you've got that Mask of the Red Death fear that when a plague is about, there's no keeping it out. But I think there's something else to this fear of transformation, that something can come out of the stars or out of the ground or out of the air itself and get into your system and turn you into something that is unrecognizable to your past self, turn you into something completely different from what you are. And that seems to be a true horror and a real fear that keeps coming up. Well, that was at the heart of Color Out of Space. The real horror was how this plague transformed not only the farm, but the family. There's this horrifying moment in Color Out of Space. I can't believe I forgot to mention when the farmer's wife starts going mad with this disease, with this strange color out of space that has infected her, that they lock her up in the attic, and she takes to crawling on all fours and shouting grand and horrifying, unthinkable prophecies, and begins to even glow, or even worse, seems to glow, but no one's quite sure whether that's in her head or in their heads, or whether this crazy mother up in the attic who's crawling on all fours and prophesying is actually glowing as well. That's an extreme transformation. But so is walking around as the dead. So is the plague that you catch in John Carpenter's The Thing, one of the coolest plagues on film, in which you've got this Antarctic base, these folks down there starring Kurt Russell, among other people. Wilford Brimley is great in that movie. This is one of John Carpenter's finest, one of his Kurt Russell projects in the early 80s. And they're down in Antarctic and they catch this extraterrestrial plague that transforms you or mutates you in this way. It makes all of your living cells fight independently for their own life, which is not at all how our bodies normally work. Even though we're made up of a whole bunch of separate living organisms, so many of them, you take one for the team, right? Like, so, like your skin does the cut, protecting you from basic cuts, even if it's at the expense of itself. But what if you were doing something for the good of your whole body that was going to harm one of your fingers? Well, your finger would reject and tear itself away and try to fight back and survive. And so with that concept, you get some, if you haven't seen it already, I really don't want to ruin this amazing, let's just call it a beheading moment that I was not prepared for it when I first watched it. Absolutely freaked me out. I kind of don't want to ruin it or spoil it any more for anybody else who might get into it. I think I told you enough of the concept to perhaps convince you to get into it if you haven't already, or maybe to remind you how cool that film was on such a low budget, if you have forgotten The Thing. The gross kind of body horror of that movie is freaky and horrifying, and that's monstrous. So maybe you don't have to dig any deeper to that fear, but I think deeper in that fear is indeed this fear of being changed or mutated by some type of contamination that's beyond your control to stop. And we fear that kind of change happening. If there is some connection back to that original idea that I stumbled with earlier in the show about maybe this, the borders and contamination and these deep essential ideas being something somehow connected to like political spectrums, then you might also say change and fear of change, or the desire for change and the resistance to change being absolutely connected to that, that the contamination that comes across the borders, it's not that it simply kills, it's that the real horror is that it changes or transforms. So I think that's maybe, there's one other aspect of plagues I kind of want to touch on, but I'm having a dilemma right now because it gets kind of iffy. I'll just say the damn thing. Okay. I've noticed already just on like social media platforms that some people are consciously or not interpreting the plague as this other kind of thing than anything I've talked about. So far, what I've talked about is this kind of invisible vampire, this thing that seeps into your home, that like sucks the vitality out of you and then transforms you into something monstrous. If that's essentially what's at the heart of a vampire, and vampires and plagues have always been inextricable, then this, the type of Mask of the Red Death, the zombie, the thing plague I've been talking about, Color Out of Space, is this kind of vampiric idea. But there's this other way to interpret plagues, and maybe the way we started the plagues of Egypt, and plagues in other works of literature as well, maybe Andromeda Strain kind of falls into that. I'd have to think about that one again. But this other interpretation of plagues as being the wrath of nature herself, or maybe even the wrath of God, but I think more often you see it as the wrath of nature. I even saw people circulating memes as in, like, they would take various images out of pop culture, they would have them kind of in a political cartoon way represent nature itself, and then the nation of China, and something about China, the Chinese government was like cruel to nature, and so this is nature's way of revenge. And I think that's, well, I don't know what I think that is. I think it's a potentially dangerous idea, but I think, you know, I think it doesn't matter my judgment on this thing, because I think it's essentially in people's minds or in people's hearts, and it has always been. Like, when, and so I say a dangerous idea. I just one of the first thoughts that came to my mind is thinking about the many thousands of people who have been who have suffered and or have died from this very real plague, somehow having to, like, they have to suffer for some completely unrelated tyrannical government's ideas about progress and nature and stuff. I think that's a bit unfair to the actual ground level, the real people who have to suffer real effects of life. But that story is an ancient one. All of the people, I mean, not all Egyptians were bad, but all Egyptians suffered, right? And so there is something to this notion that when a plague hits, it's the larger force, whether nature or God or whichever you feel like saying is over humankind or superhuman, the superhuman, it's the wrath of the gods coming down. And then that immediately leads into kind of either apocalyptic kind of notions or just essential change notion, as in, after this, then people will have a revelation, awaken, change their ways. I think that's kind of at the heart of some of those versions of plague stories. They seem perhaps in a different kind of category than some of the more vampiric plague stories. But maybe even there, at its heart, as its ultimate goal, you have transformation, mutation, change, which is a deep-seated fear in a lot of monster stories. So, but yeah, there are so many monstrous plagues that I didn't cover. I think a lot of them are covered well in a survey, that article by Adam Roberts. So let me plug in one more time. Check that out, Fever Dreams. But I don't think you really got at the ones that I really enjoy like I just did. And so there you go. So that's my take on monstrous plagues. And I hope the best for you out there. Who knows what's going to happen. Hopefully a lot of no more than what has already happened with the many other popular plagues that have come along in the past decade or two, which have been many and many. But who knows? So regardless, I'm going to, as best I can, keep plugging away on cool episodes as I have cool content. So subscribe and like and support if in any way you can. If you're a fan of the show, spread the word. That probably helps more than anything, honestly. And so I hope you enjoyed it, because you just survived another episode of The Monster Professor.